eternity. And now the humans turn against us thanks to Serena Butler. We must endure for the prosperity.
Butlerians unite! This is Varian Atreides, and we will turn the tide! We will take the war to the thinking machines, and we will endure as the human race survives. Here, from Seleucus Secundus and more, we will endure for the might of humanity.
You are listening to Fandom Podcast Network's The Mullet Guild, brought to you by the Little Mullet. Secret report from the guild. The mullet has the spice. The spice must flow. You must listen to the Mullet Guild.
Welcome to the Mullet Guild, a special look at Dune from Fandom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet. Find all about the Dune universe here on this podcast. This podcast is for people that have never read Dune and are going into the movie in December 18 this year. Find out all about the world, the planet Arrakis, the different schools, the Swordmasters, the Mentats, the Bene Gesserit, and of course the Navigators. Find out about the medical Sook doctors. Find out about the Atreides, House Carino, and House Harkonnen, all here on Fandom Podcast Network's The Mullet Guild, hosted by the Lethal Mullet.
Hey there, Dune fans, what's happening? This here is the Lethal Mullet, here for another episode, episode number 5 of the Mullet Guild. And tonight we're going to be looking at the Butlerian Jihad. And we also have a guest joining us a little bit later too, which is, of course, the co-founder of Fandom Podcast Network, the one, the only, Kyle Wagner, of course, who founded this network with Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel back in the old days. And let's just say it has grown since then and become what it is today, which is a great, warm place for all fans to come and enjoy all areas of fandom. And there's some really great shows out recently too, folks. You can check out recently Couch Potato Theatre with Kevin, Lee, and a dear friend of theirs as well, looking at Punisher Warzone from 2009, which is pretty much the Punisher comes straight into the film from the comics. It is brilliant. It's fantastic. You got to go and check it out. But tonight, yes, we are going to be looking at some very spicy stuff. And of course, that is the Butlerian Jihad. Now, these are the books that were created by Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert many years after Frank had passed, unfortunately. And Frank had lit sort of the groundwork, obviously, for sequels in the last couple of books, which is, of course, Heretics of Dune and Chapter House. And it was leading to, a Dune 7, and which was all planned to continue. But unfortunately, he passed before he could get those stories out, and his son, Brian, decided to continue that journey. And part of that was also laying some groundwork, what would be basically the prequel era, or basically the history to Dune. And you really need it to continue the story and where they were going. Part of that, of course, is the much-heralded Butlerian Jihad, the overthrowing of the thinking machines and the growing of the great schools of humanity. Of course, Bene Gesserit's, the Navigators and the Space and Guild, and of course, the many other schools, the Sook schools, the Mentats, and of course, the Swordmasters of Ginaz. All of that, all to the one great book, Dune, of course. And of course, we developed humanity from that. So obviously, the Great Revolt happened, and we're going to talk about that tonight. So it is a very interesting part of Dune history, and those that don't even know those, haven't read it yet, you know, there's details in the Frank's books about it to a certain extent. There's little bits and hints and stuff like that, and a lot of it's too through the mentors, to whether it's Paul or others in the story, you get a little bit of a hint of what happened many, many millennia before. Even this period is far removed from where we are here in, of course, 2020. The original stories were set in 10,191. Now, that's 10,000, but in guild years, so after guild, AG, which is roughly about 20,000 years AD.
So you can kind of get an idea of just how far advanced this is. But we're going to talk about a little bit of that history, and we'll even look at some from the old Dune Encyclopedia as well. And I tell you what, if you've got a copy of that, hold on to it, because they're worth a bit now. You only go on eBay and stuff like that, and you can see how much they're really worth. But before we get into the Dune details tonight, let's let you know how you can catch this show and many others on the Phantom Podcast Network. Thank you for checking out The Mullet Guild on the Phantom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show at fpnet.podbean.com. That's the master feed where you'll find all the shows on the network. You can also follow me, The Lethal Mullet, at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Mullet Deed. What spicy news do you have for us here at Siege Quinlan?
Nice! All the way from Siege Quinlan, well, I tell you what, I've got some news for you. All the way from Arakeen. Alright, so before we get into the big news of the week and what's happening here, just a little bit of an update on Phantom Podcast Network itself. We've currently got, just on a Lethal Mullet podcast, Bill and Ted's Excellent Mullet episode out, looking at my love of that film and, of course, the franchise. And, of course, Face of Music is just around the corner, so go and check that out. We've also got the Batman show recorded and still editing, folks, so hang in there. It will be coming, and I would dare say we'll probably put it at the same time that I'm putting out the Batman Returns show, which will have myself. I think it's going to have Lee Fillingsness, and most likely going to have one or two others that are new to the network coming on as well, which would be great. Because that's, again, an unsung part of the Batman mythos. It's a great little movie. It's quite dark, very Tim Burton. But again, it's, yeah, the iMac is struggling with the amount of audio we've got for that episode. So we will get it out to you with the best quality we can as soon as possible. But again, a celebration of 1989's amazing Batman film. It's still to this day is one of the greatest. Now, there's also news that we're getting a 4K restoration of David Lynch's Dune. Now, this will be the theatrical cut most likely. I don't think you're going to see the Alan Smithy cut come through. But don't expect anything involving David Lynch. Again, he disowns this film. And, again, it was his last big mainstream blockbuster experience as a filmmaker. Again, obviously he's moved into TV with Twin Peaks and many other great films, but again, not on the sort of scale that he had with David Lynch's Dune. Now, to a 4K release is going to be quite interesting and amazing, and I can't wait to get into that too. It's going to be great. The other thing I've been checking out is Toto's soundtrack, and also really getting into Toto as a band. Obviously, amazing musicians and in rock and many other genres that they've really played with. Probably best known for Africa. But also, the great thing is they're playing a lot of their stuff live. So if you haven't heard Dune live, well, you can, going to a Toto concert. And Steve Lukather on guitar is just really banging out those classics, you know, the themes from Dune. And if you haven't seen it, go onto YouTube and just actually search Dune Toto, I think it's called the Desert Theme, and you actually see it play live, and they've got that beautiful piano sort of scale going, along with the guitar, and then the drums as well. It's just everything in harmony, and it's a beautiful score. If there's one thing that the film did right, it was the score. Beautiful, and I don't think even Hans Zimmer could create such an iconic and memorable score. But, again, great. And if you can find the release of those, which is very hard to find now these days, the actual soundtrack and its longer version, I think you could find it definitely on Spotify is where I found good copies of it. But you can get one that was released in the late 90s, 97 or something like that, and there's different edits and cuts of some of those songs too, and some that weren't used on the film as well. So go and check it out, because, again, it is a beautiful score. It's up there for me with Blade Runner, as far as great scores, and even John Williams' work as well, is an absolutely gorgeous score.
It is noted in each of the teachings of the Mentor that there must be appendices for you to learn more about the world in which you live.
Well, that's great. You're going to teach me some new stuff, are you, fella?
There is much to be learned here, so listen carefully and learn all that is to be learned.
All right, folks, we're going to look at the Dune Encyclopedia, which was something that came out around the time of the Dune film or just before. And again, highly thought on as the ultimate source when it come to the history of the Dune saga. But also, it's at a time when not all the Dune books were written. So I think it was up to God Emperor of Dune at that time. What's interesting about the actual book itself is that it's very, very hard to find. And I had at one stage years ago, this is about probably about 10 years, I had a chance to actually get a copy, but it slipped through my fingers. and it was only around about, I think, $25 at the time. It wasn't the best condition. So that's why I wasn't too sore in losing it. But years later, lucky at a bookstore in the Gold Coast of Australia, where I found a beautiful copy, and that's what I have today. And it's almost pristine condition, almost. But the big thing about the Dune Encyclopedia itself too, if you do get a copy, is that you're getting a history of Dune that's different than what is out there, obviously, that Kevin and Brian have done since. But it's an eye-opening into what was thought of at the time and gives you a bit of an idea about where maybe Frank's head was at when it comes to the history and the Dune saga. So what we're actually going to look at tonight from that is the chronology they've got at the start, which is a little timeline, giving you an idea about what things were happening in the Dune universe, also what things were happening in our time in Guild timeline, if you like. So just like Andro Domini, you know, AD, this is, of course, a timeline they use in the Dune universe because the Guild basically is at such a point where obviously we get space travel at such great navigation-wise, you know, accuracy and stuff like that. It's such a groundbreaking time for the Spacing Guild to monopolize everything and become such a huge element in the universe, opening up all those doorways. So again, it is something that's really, at the end of the day, celebrated in that universe. So for that, they have basically set their timeline around it. So BG is before Guild. And just to give you a little bit of an idea where things are set, how far before. And just with the caveat that this has changed somewhat, obviously, since the Butler and Jihad and the Legends of Dune series, the Schools of Dune have come through since. So about 19,000 years before Guild, and early civilizations began on Terra. Now, Terra is Earth, and we're talking obviously about our own history here at this stage too. The great Alexander brought his empire together in ancient Greece in 16,500 BG. So you can see as we're starting to count it down and even further. So there was also the Roman Empire came into play around 16,400 to 16,000 before Guild. So as we're starting to come back, you can see that it's still so far removed and it keeps going forward. So 14,500 to 14,200, the golden age of invention, development of radio, television, atomics, rocketry, genetics, and the computer. So that is our time. That's our last century, the 19th century, basically. And of course, that is a build of, you know, the space federations and stuff like that too. In 14,255, the first atomics demonstrated the intro provisional war. Seat of Washington became the seat of power at that time. So this is where we start to get into some of the fictional history, if you like, of the Dune universe. So that's starting to veer away from what we already have. So we have parts like these little wars that start to happen. So we have the Ceres gained the imperial seat after a planetoid strikes Earth. Now, part of the history of both is that Earth faces not only war but calamity from outside, where basically becomes almost devoid of life, to the point where you can't actually physically live on the planet anymore safely.
So as we go further up, we have the little diaspora. The solar system is completely colonized, and the population of Earth eventually outnumbered 20 to 1. So, you know, we're starting to see the spread, the basic spread. What you see in most science fiction stories is that our solar system first gets colonized, and then we spread out from there. Then we have the Empire of 10 Worlds, communications becoming strained. So as they're starting to spread out in about 12,000 BG, they're starting to see little empires forming. And again, this is becoming something that's going to become the great houses down the line. In 11,105, the Age of Pretenders begins, when Ceres is destroyed by rebellion and the imperial seat ceases to exist as a single entity. So I think part of what we're starting to see in this latter part is not only the, you know, the unification of different groups to become houses, but, you know, seats themselves, the imperial seat itself is getting strained as well, and it will have to become something larger in the long run. So as we go through, we also see the age of 10,000 emperors, sometimes called the Great Dark Ages, which is about 11,000 to 7,000. And in this time, we've also got Holtzman becoming an element in the stories. Now, of course, Holtzman is one that makes so much technology in this period that it changes humanity from not only being somebody that can stay in the one area of the universe, but it can really spread out even further. So again, this really shows you the difference between something like Star Wars, Star Trek, and vice versa, where they're using such limited forms of space travel, like FTL and warp drive, all that sort of stuff. With the universe of Dune, you can travel even further, and of course much larger distances with the way that the spice enhances the abilities of the navigators and, of course, these humongous ships and stuff like that that they've got. So Holtzman reveals the wave effect nature of the suspensor nullification device. So we're starting to see, again, things like shield technology starting to come into play here, the generators. In 7500, the wars of reunification, consequent on the immediate communication made possible by the Holtzman effect. So technologies that can push communication further and further. Now, of course, we know in the real world, radio waves and stuff like that can't really push through fast through space. Obviously, it takes time. So again, different technologies enhancing that to make it possible that it's faster. So in 2000 BG, we have the return of the computer, sometimes called the second reunification. Tensions increase in program mites and humanity versus tensions with Jahan Butler about to exploit. Of course, in 200 BG, we have the Butlerian Jihad. So that's where it sort of comes up to at that point in the story, where we get, obviously, the version of events that we're having in the Dune saga before Brian and Kevin had come along and done a slightly different story. But in this part, we get the idea that the Butlerian Jihad itself is still such a huge pivotal point. And again, it's like war in most times, or any conflict. It enforces a change in technologies and ways of thinking to better humanity fast. You know, it's a survival sort of instinct when it comes to bettering technology. You only got to look at the wars that we've had in the last century past. World War II is a perfect example. Moving such fast through all forms of, whether it's weapons, transport, the invention of the jet, the assault rifle, things like that, all in times of war and need. So again, the Butlerian Jihad did that, but it forced humanity not only to give up machines, thinking machines, but to better humankind and push it further to the limit.
Rightio.
Time to go down to the pub.
Have myself a spice beer, like a Pilsner.
Pilsen is pretty good.
Could be a little bit of, you know, pale ale, a bit of pale spice ale.
It's good stuff too, mate.
Let's get into it.
All
right, we're going to chat about the Legends of Dune series, obviously written by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, and came out just after the Prelude of Dune series, which, of course, was the return to the Dune line of books after so many years. And, of course, Brian got Kevin J. Anderson involved to help him carve out this great storyline that we got. Published by Tor Books in 2002 was Butlerian Jihad, which is the start of the trilogy that really looked at the Machine Crusade itself, and of course then had a sequel, The Machine Crusade and The Battle of Corin. Again, that's a very interesting book alone by itself, because that gives us the real sense of what happened between the Harkonnen and Atreides conflict, and of course the bitter betrayal that obviously had that vengeance factor for both, all the way through bitter rivals, right up to, of course, the original book itself too. It's got an amazing cover, if you haven't seen it before, with, of course, by Stephen Yule, who always does great covers of books. But, I mean, in the Dune series in particular, I think he outdoes himself every time. They're beautiful. And so that sort of beautiful gold inlay as well with the Butlerian Jihad. And you can't miss the cover because it says Dune. out here in Australia, we got a slightly different cover of that series. And it's same with the others, I think, because we got it wasn't published by Tor out here. It was published by another publisher altogether. But still, beautiful. We still got the same story. And it's a very interesting sort of turn of events. So it opens with, of course, the Atreides, the Harkonnen, and, of course, what will become the Carino family as well, with Serena Butler, who's the daughter of the leader of the League of Nobles. And she's such a strong and powerful voice of the human rebellion against the machines. And then we also have from the Harkonnens, Xavier Harkonnen, who is basically the head of the military. Very cool character. Actually, Xavier is probably one of the best characters in the series. And he leads the military for the League of Nobles, and all comes from, of course, Seleucus Secundus. Now, we all remember Seleucus Secundus from the original books being the old imperial seat, and became basically a prison world, one that was destroyed by atomics and much more. So as it opens, Xavier is repelling an entire attack against the armies of the machines. Now, the machines have an army made of Cymex, which is basically spider-like robots, if you like. These machines that are just almost unstoppable. They are led by Omnius, obviously, who's the head of the machines, and this Evermind that controls everything. And the Cymex are basically former humans who have had their brains taken and put into preserved canisters. These preservation canisters then can be taken and put into any type of figure, any type of machine. But these are mechanical bodies that are just built for war, basically, for terror, for horror. The original lot of had 20 of them, and these were people that were called Titans. They were basically tyrannical leaders. But they're taken over by Omnius, who is the AI they designed. And he gave them all the options to become Cymex and to live forever, basically. So once you're free of your body, your mind can be locked into one of these, and just you can just pretty much be immortal. One of these Titans is by the name of Agamemnon, of course, named after the House of Atreus, leader back from the old Greek times. And of course, Agamemnon is that tie to the past, if you like. So it goes all the way back to that original ancient Greek part of the Iliad. Now, part of that is that he has a human son, and his son is called Vorion Atreides. And of course, in the start of the story, he's actually with the Cymex. He's with Agamemnon as basically a second lieutenant, if you like, and he doesn't know any different at the time. What we do see over the coming books and into the school series is one of the most interesting characters, and arguably
more interesting than even Paul Atreides, Varian Atreides. I think it's one of the greatest characters ever brought out in this series. It's a character very much like Captain America, is that he's, you know, born of one time, but he gets to live into the future as well later in the series. It's a bit of a spoiler, but if you're coming here, you probably already know that. And through that story, we get to see him, obviously, eventually cross over and meet the Harkonnen leader, Xavier, and, of course, eventually, Serena Butler as well. In this story, we also get to see Theo Holtzman, who is obviously going to go on to create some of the greatest technologies ever, and, of course, Norma Senva, who will eventually find something very interesting with the spice itself too. In the story, Serena is basically brought to the fore and captured by one of the Titans by the name of Barbarossa. And at that time then, put under the evil watch of some character that's going to be huge in this series, which is, of course, Erasmus. It's an AI and a robot who basically is just very curious. He wants to find out what makes humanity tick. And he really has kind of an inkling here and there, and he has that feeling of, you know, what is it that makes humanity different from us? Why are they not so perfect, and vice versa? This character will become even more important in books to come. So it's something that obviously calculations, something that really bases around computers, how things tick, possibly might just have something to do with Mentats down the line. So you can kind of see where they're going there too. Again, this is all about a revolt, obviously, too. We start to see humanity turning against their captors. We also have in this story some great little insights into the start of things on Arrakis as well, not just from the spice side of things, but also what will become the Fremen down the line as well. So this really is the start of everything for Dune, and it's a great book. I've always enjoyed reading. I've read it about probably four times now. And with the new recent release from Tor Books, the trilogy pack, I'm now going to be rereading those very soon after Navigators of Dune, which I'm finally reading. So again, it's a great start. You get a real interesting mix of characters, which we're going to start with now. Serena Butler, obviously, the intelligent leader, and also one that's going to really get the fire going for humanity from Seleucus Secundus. We've got Xavier Harkonnen, which we talked about. Varian, or better known as Vor Atreides, obviously has his own ship, the Dream Voyager, in this one too. And he's the co-pilot of that. We've got Iblis Ginjo, and he's one of the human leaders on Earth. Erasmus, an AI. Agamemnon, which we've talked about. Norma Senva, who's the dwarf and mathematical genius from Rossak in this series. Theo Holtzman, an inventor for Poratron. We have Zufa Senva, the powerful sorceress of Rossak, and she's also Norma Senva's mother. We have Aurelius Venport, a Rossak businessman, and of course Zufa Senva's mate as well. Obviously Omnius we've talked about, but some of the other characters that are interesting, we've got Ajax, the most hardcore of the 20 Titans. Juno, who's a female Somak and one of the Titans. She's also the lover of Agamemnon in this story. We also have Mannion Butler, who's the leader of the League of Nobles, the Viceroy, and of course Serena's father. And yeah, many others. We've got Xerxes also as well in this too, and many others. So again, this is huge. When it came out, it was quite big here in Australia. And we really got it. Again, it's, in some ways, I remember a lot of people likening it to its Star Wars mash with Terminator because of the, obviously, the story is a little bit like Terminator. You know, did James Cameron steal from this older sort of idea of the story? Who knows? But I think, in the end of the day, it's bigger than that because we're getting the starts of what will be the closing down of things like the technology of the machines, and the opening of things like we're going to see in the later parts of the Dune saga. So it's massive, it's huge, it's great, and well worth checking out for your Dune reading pleasure.
Hey guys, welcome back to the tail end of the show tonight, where we're joined by the creator of this amazing channel, the Phantom Podcast Network, along with, of course, Kevin the Radio Nerd Russell. Carl Wagner brings us daily all the news that's fit to print when it comes to all your fandoms that you're welcome to. Of course, this is a very welcoming place of all fandoms on the Phantom Podcast Network. And of course, Carl Wagner joins us here today to celebrate his love of Dune. Mate, how are you?
I am doing well. I'm ready to talk a little Dune, though. You know what? We had been discussing holding me off until the Dune trailer actually came out to discuss things. But, you know, things happen. And, Adam, when are we going to see a Dune trailer?
Well, you know, they said July 17, but I'm thinking it may even be later now.
They need to just... This is where, because we're in the world we are now. I know you've talked about things closing back up over where you're at in Australia. Things are kind of doing that here, unless you live in my state of Florida, when that's a whole other mess. But they just need to put this trailer out online on the 17th and roll with it, because they need to start selling this movie.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, there's a Dune cult following, but if you're trying to get this movie to be the franchise that you want it to be and to be appealing to the masses, you've got to start selling it. We're less than 6 months away from it supposedly coming out.
And the thing is, you know, there's a mainstream audience that only knows Dune from some crazy movie that David Lynch did back in the 1980s, or that sci-fi miniseries that came out and started James McAvoy's career. That's it.
Well, or you've got even a whole generation that's really never experienced Dune in their lifetime. As far as maybe they've read the book, but they might not have gone back and seen the movie. And the sci-fi series miniseries is not easy to come by right now.
No, and the other reference out there in recent years is in Ready Player One, when they talk about a Harkonnen frigate in the movie, and that's it.
That's it. And I think you know, a lot of people are excited about the casting in Dune, but they've got to sell it. And Dune is not... While Dune is outstanding science fiction, it's not an easy sell in science fiction, because it's got the problem of it being an incredibly intelligent science fiction. And when you look throughout movie history, high intelligence science fiction doesn't really go over well in the theater. If you think about it, Blade Runner wasn't a huge theatrical hit. Mm-hmm. Blade Runner 2049 wasn't a huge theatrical hit. Annihilation, even Arrival, which has got a ton of critical acclaim, it didn't exactly blow up in the box office itself either. So, and I think that's one of the biggest obstacles Dune has had in any iteration is... It's so intelligent, and there's a lot of above-the-head thought processes in it that you're going to have to, you know, it's a tough balancing act to get it to be appeal to mass audiences and then still deliver a quality product. And I think the other thing, Adam, and I want to ask you this, because it's something I've seen, is that they're talking a three-hour runtime just for part one.
Yes, 100%. That's what is being heard of right now. And we're talking about... You know, a film that will most likely only get up to the point where Jessica and Paul are, you know, not captured, but find Stilgar after they crash their Thopter. Yeah. They're in the desert. They've just survived Shai Hulud trying to chop him up and have his daily breakfast, basically, on, you know. And the thing is, it's after everything has fallen apart. So it's a natural sort of point. But does it need 3 hours to tell that? No, I think the 3 hours they should be doing is in the second part, which is, of course, building up the mystique of who Paul Muad'Dib is, you know, when he becomes Usul, when he gets his training in. And that's what the miniseries did better.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, and I do think between the sci-fi miniseries and the movie, the miniseries is a superior piece of work as far as covering Dune. But, you know, it's 3 hours as an investment into something to start off with is not the best of decisions. I can push 2:15, but, you know, Endgame, which was almost 3 hours, but that was the finale. That we had built up to that. People were already hooked in and invested.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. I love the world of Dune. The books are a heavy read, but there's so much there that they can develop from, but you've got to do it in the right way. And I'm not, as much as I love Denis Denny, and I'm hopeful for what they're going to do here. But if they're wanting to turn this into a tentpole franchise, Adam, I'm not sure if they're doing it the proper way.
I have a feeling, and I've chatted to some pals, which I won't go too much into because, again, it's probably a little bit closer to the project. But, you know, perhaps some of us are looking at this film the wrong way, is that maybe it's not a tentpole. Maybe this film is going to be a bit more of an art house film. Maybe it's going to... The thing that I'm getting from not only them, but it's others, the scale that I'm thinking this movie at is smaller, in my mind, than what they have. What they've got coming, we won't understand the scale. It's massive. Apparently, this is a huge scale. That's part of the reason they're extending the story the way it is. And it probably is to do with what they're planning to do on TV with it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, here's one of the other problems, at least I'm going to tell you about here in the States. The HBO Max launch is not going quite as well as expected. There's some issues because they can't decide what they want to do with the tie-in DC Universe app. It's not on a... They have not been able to reach contracts with a couple of the major streaming distributors, Roku and Amazon, mm-hmm. for it yet. So that's a big hang-up. And two, I mean, people are... I mean, they've changed the planning of it. People are now getting HBO Max who had an HBO subscription through their cable service.
Oh, really?
So... Yeah, HBO Max is kind of, I'm not saying it's failing, but it's not hitting like they thought it was going to.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Out here in Australia, unfortunately with HBO, we have a bit of an issue. One of the huge cable companies out here called Foxtel, so one that covers pretty much Australia, and I believe New Zealand as well, has the rights to all HBO shows. So you can't just watch Watchmen now on a HBO service out here because we don't have it. We don't have access to it. So I have a feeling that we will get it on another streaming channel here.
Yeah, and it's a possibility, but you have to remember it's been somewhat exclusive to, it's supposed to be exclusive to HBO Max.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about a lot of contract reworkings and things like that. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see because Dune is on such a weird position with its media history.
That's right.
The books are so well received, but I mean, you have the Lynch's Dune, which has some interesting aspects to it, but for the most part, most people kind of pan that movie. You have the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, which actually was very well done, but it's just dated in the actual effects, and it's very hard to come by. You can actually get this follow-up, Children of Dune. You can mm-hmm. find that a lot easier than you can actually find the actual Dune miniseries itself.
That's right. Now, folks, we're going to quickly give you an oversight onto what the TV show will be about. Now, the book that this is going to be based off is called Sisterhood of Dune, and it's set after the legacy era or the legend era of Dune, so after they've toppled the machines. Here's a quick bit of the blurb. 83 years after the last of the Thing machines were destroyed in the Battle of Corran, the grandson of Faken Butler, Emperor Salvador, rules the Imperium, but his power is threatened by rabidly anti-technology men by Manfred Torondo and his million-strong mob sweeping across the universe. Meanwhile, the hero of Corran, the Battle of Corran, Vorian Atreides, has turned his back on politics to live on the remote Kepler, a little-known, Griffin Harkonnen and Valya Harkonnen, holding Vordor account for their family's downfall. And on Rossak, the sisters of the Bene Gesserit plot against the Imperium. On Lampadar's Gilbert Elbans, trainer of the first Mentats, protege of the detested robot Erasmus, and keeper of an unbelievable secret, is dragged into the conflict by the fanatic Torondo. In the middle of everything, Venport Holdings starts saturating the first of the navigators with spice. So you can see what their TV series will be about the start of everything.
Yeah, and... The question is this TV series doesn't come out till after Dune hits.
Correct.
So is that the best of decisions? Because this might have been a good way to kind of at least get people a little more familiar with the world if they put it out beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
I think again, the issue being is maybe even if they would have put out like a little hour special or something like that, just kind of giving the basics of Dune before this movie comes out. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. I mean, diehard fans of Dune are diehard. I mean, they've read everything. They know everything backwards and forwards. The average fan of Dune has maybe read the book, the original Dune book, and seen the movie or the show. And then you've got the people who have just seen the movie or attempted the movie or have seen the miniseries that Sci-Fi Channel did. The big thing for me is which direction they want to go with this. Because with the casting and all the money they put into it and everything, it feels like they want to make it a big franchise for them. But on the other hand, how they're approaching it right now, and I don't know if it's because of the COVID situation and maybe them holding back, I still wonder if they're not going to be forced at this point, if theaters keep getting delayed, to push it out of that Christmas time slot it's in.
It's an interesting time that they put it in. Obviously, they realized Star Wars is not releasing anything. Star Trek was not releasing anything. It was kind of a given because obviously the following one, we got Avatar coming in 2021 with a sequel. So going head-to-head with Avatar would be commercial suicide. But I think, you know, maybe if this is dragged back till May or June next year, give them time, and then hammer out a TV series starting in November, that could be interesting.
Well, here's my thought process on it too, Adam, is that what you're looking at is, let's say we even get delayed for another month or two. You're looking now at being on top of and around a major Marvel movie in Black Widow, a new Bond film, several other big, I mean, the summer movie season has basically been killed by COVID.
Yeah.
And they're not, the studios are being kind of stubborn at this point, saying we're not putting anything else on video on demand,
mm-hmm.
as far as our big film. So you're looking at Dune now, all of a sudden, where it didn't think it was going to have much competition around Christmas time, now looking at having a lot of competition in the box office around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do they want to be going up against, do they want Dune to be sandwiched between two Marvel movies?
No,
that
definitely
close
not.
Together? Because you're talking about, right now, you're talking about October, November for Black Widow. You're talking October for Wonder Woman. You're talking November for Bond. Dune in December with a lot of things being shifted around. And then Eternals in February.
Yes.
And so, is there a fear of Dune getting lost in the shuffle a little bit?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I think it has to be put out at the right time, especially if this is going to have the same feel that 2049 had, a bit of a slow burn. But from what I gather, this film's going to be more headlong lines of space and espionage. This is going to be a real assassin-style thing, because at the end of the day, that's what that first half is. They're trying to kill the Duke.
Yeah.
When it gets into it.
But, okay, so one of the questions I have for you, Adam, is 3-hour runtime. Right now, they're saying for the first part. Are we at a point where people want to go sit in the theater for 3 hours to watch this?
I think their argument is, look at the Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings. You know, people want a literal translation, adaptation of a book. And if they're going to get it, it's going to need time. Are people going to sit through that? Probably if they're fans. But if they're new to it, it'll only be people that have, you know some type of inkling of what Dune is.
I guess the question is being too is what's the movie theater experience going to be like at that point? And that's what people are already been so cooped up so long. Do they want to be cooped up in a movie theater with other people for 3 hours?
Yeah, well, that's the other issue too. Or do they even want to risk December being a time when we'll probably have to still social distance, but most likely anyway. By that time, still be wearing masks, all that sort of stuff by that time. And by the way, anywhere in the world, wear a damn mask, for crying out loud. Save a life. But at the end of the day, you know, they just need to get something out there. Now, what I have heard on the grapevine is we're getting 4 mini movies. So 4 little, I suppose, 10-minute shorts, if you like. A little bit like they did with 2049, which are going to introduce people to the series. So I dare say we're going to get this as kind of like, because there is apparently a 10-minute prologue in the movie itself too.
Well, that's kind of the history of Dune and film as well, whether it's a sci-fi miniseries or Lynch's Dune. There's always about a good 5-10-minute prologue in the case, kind of set things up.
Oh, definitely. Now, I've got a question for you. You've seen the photos. You've seen what Variety have put out Obviously, we got a bit of an inkling about what House Atreides looks like. We've seen, obviously, some of the Fremen now. But what's interesting is they're wearing this weird body armor with the Atreides are wearing. Do you think this is the activated shields?
It could be. You know, the visuals that they've put out for this are absolutely breathtaking. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I have no concerns about this movie as far as a visual side of things. I think this is going to be visually spectacular and a movie that most people need to go see on a big screen if we can have a proper big screen experience when it comes out. But yeah, I don't know. It could be shields. It could be something else. You know, I think that's the biggest thing is the feeling of unknown still with this film.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, again, we've always been told that this has a real horror factor to the design and look of it. You know, this has sort of a real, a monstrous sort of feel to the architecture. And that's something that Oscar Isaac said in an interview. He said, you know, this movie looks like hell. And maybe that's got that sort of factor. We still haven't seen the Harkonnens yet.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting. I don't think you're going to see too much more revealed until they put out a trailer. I think it's a smart move at this point, but they need to have the trailer out by the end of July. That's just my feeling on it. Again, if I think they need to just realize, guess what? We need to just take this online, put it out. I mean, because they're not, from what you said, they're not doing anything with any of these virtual cons either.
No, they're not. The only thing I do have news-wise is that Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert have got a new book coming out centered around Duke Leto. It's called The Duke of Caladan. And that's coming out, I think it's in late September or October. So you'll get something around that time as well. Plus, if you're into the games, guys, there's a new RPG that's in beta testing right now. You can apply for the beta of the game itself if you have an RPG group. But you do have to be part of, obviously, the non-disclosure agreement they have there too. So you'd be under NDA if you do have it, so you can't review it or anything like that until it's properly released. But again, that looks interesting too.
Are we sure J.J. Abrams isn't in charge of Dune?
Well, the world has obviously moved Mr. J.J. into DC. The news is that he is now going to be doing a Justice League Rebirth.
I think, I know we're about Dune, but I need to hit on this for just a minute because I've been talking about this with a lot of people. I think a lot of what the future rides on is what happens with the Snyder Cut. I think you have two major factors for the DC Universe. What's going to happen with the Snyder Cut, because I think if people respond very strongly to the Snyder Cut, it makes them stop and pause and think about how they're doing. And also the Flashpoint film, because the Flashpoint film is their opportunity to do at least a soft reset and still keep Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot involved and Henry Cavill. There are rumors that Ben Affleck has signed to do something for Batman with HBO Max. I've not heard that from too many legitimate sources, but that rumor is floating around. But the DC Universe has got itself in a very interesting place, and we still don't know what the fate of Ezra Miller as the Flash is either. So this is an interesting time for them. But they kind of have, there's a window of opportunity right now with Star Wars kind of on hiatus, except for streaming. And with Marvel going into a phase four, that's probably the most uncertain phase of their history since phase one.
Oh, 100%. I think the end of the day is my biggest critique of the DC Universe is not sticking with a vision and having the confidence to stay with it.
Yeah, I think they tried to fast forward themselves way too much here. And, you know, this is a big thing, and it actually ties into our Dune conversation, because we have a TV show. We know we have at least two parts of Dune coming out. I think those for sure are both coming out. But what's going to happen going forward if this movie, if the first one doesn't do well, if the first one does not pull in big box office numbers?
100%. You know, is it just going to go straight to a mini series format after that? I mean, those are the sorts of things they got to look for. But I think my biggest question to you before we wrap is, what would you like in to see in Dune merch, if you could, once the movie comes out?
I would love to see a decent toy line with the vehicles, especially. Even some hard merchandise. I mean, it truly is, because how do you sell the worm?
Well, they did, and it's like $700 on eBay still today.
Yeah. I think I'll have a better idea for that once I see what the Hark, what appearance they go with for the Harkonnen.
Oh, without a doubt.
I think that's a big thing. I think right now for merchandising, you stick to some basic clothing, some figures or model kits, and then we'll kind of go from there. But I don't see this as a big kind of merchandising type film, honestly.
No, I will say this. Whatever they do is going to be brutalist because that's basically what they've said is the look. I think you're going to see something very similar to the Lynch version. You only got to look at the still suits. It's pretty much the Lynch version still. Because I think he's a bit of a fan, old Denis Villeneuve there. So go and check those out, folks, and check out some of his interviews in Variety as well. Talks about his hints to The Godfather being a bit of an influence on this adaptation too. So, but before we wrap, where can we find you on the web, my friend?
Of course, you can find me all over here on the Phantom Podcast Network. And of course, you can follow me on social media at either AKyleW on Twitter or at AKyleFandom on Instagram. And of course, you can follow me too, as I'm constantly posting things on the Phantom Podcast Network Facebook group as well.
Awesome. Go and check them out, folks. And of course, a big thanks to Kyle for joining us on the show tonight.
Absolutely. And I will be back once the trailer comes out, because I promised you I'd be down for discussion once the trailer comes out. So I'll be back for that.
Awesome. And folks, we'll catch you next week, next Thursday, as we look at The Machine Crusade here on the one, the only Moloch Guild. For now, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. That's all we have time for here tonight on The Moloch Guild, brought to you by Phantom Podcast Network's The Lethal Moloch Podcast, brought to you live by C.H. Quinlan. And we'll be back with more spicy news and spicy details from Frank Herbert's Dune universe, all here on Thursdays on, of course, the Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to check it out at the master feed of fbnet.podbean.com or your podcatcher of choice. Check it out and also follow us at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram for more news, more awesomeness, and more pop culture for you, the listener of the show. And we'll catch you next week. Until then, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. And make sure you check out the trailer soon of Dune. We'll catch you next time here on the Moloch Guild.
All voices on this podcast were from a Mentat order. No worms were harmed in the production of this podcast.